The inside story of President Trump's Pentagon under Defense Secretary General James Mattis holding the line versus Trump's America First challenging of our allies with his chief speechwriter and director of communications. Guy Bus Snodgrass served as director of communications and chief speechwriter to Secretary of Defense James Mattis, a former naval aviator, served as commanding officer of a fighter squadron based in Japan, as a Top Gun instructor, and a combat pilot over the skies of Iraq as part of his 20-year Navy career. Today, he's the founder and CEO of Defense Analytics, a strategic consulting and advisory firm, and his new book is Holding the Line, Inside Trump's Pentagon with Secretary Mattis. Welcome, Commander Snodgrass, U.S. Navy retired, right?
You bet. Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Let me ask you a question first off. That Secretary Mattis has gone out of his way to say that he's not going to make comments about the Trump administration, I guess until maybe years down the road. Did he sanction what you're doing, or tell me?
Well, it's one of the things that, you know, as we talked about before, I mean, I'm a longtime military officer. I think there's a right way and a wrong way to do things. The right way, certainly, is to keep your boss informed. So Secretary Mattis and I have exchanged emails, phone calls. You know, I kept him in the loop all the way forward to make sure that he felt comfortable with what I was producing in my book. And, of course, as you may have noticed, he had his own book recently come out as well that
right.
kind of gives a look back into his career as a Marine Corps officer.
What don't we know about General Mad Dog Mattis? First off, he doesn't like Mad Dog, right?
That's one thing you probably don't know. I mean, it became incredibly popular. Members of the media liked the moniker Mad Dog, and
yeah.
of course, President Trump himself picked it up. Yeah. But that's not what he actually goes by. He goes by CHAOS, which is an acronym, which stands for Colonel Has an Outstanding Solution, because he was a Marine Corps colonel who always had these bright ideas and was just running his troops ragged.
is there basic stuff we don't know about him?
You know, I think with any public figure, that's true. You know, it's interesting because when you have an opportunity to work in those circles with senior leaders, they have very carefully crafted public personas. And then, of course, how they operate, the way they operate behind the scenes is usually different. But that's one thing I really liked about working with General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, was the fact that in many cases, his desire to serve the country, his desire to put the country first, quite frankly, was both the same publicly as it was privately. And I found that to be very reassuring.
Now, you hear all these things, incompetent, dysfunction, unstable, erratic, out of the Trump administration. On the other hand, maybe he was right that we should just be getting out of these countries, Syria and Afghanistan. Talk what it was like having to deal with the sort of the chaos of the administration.
You make a great point that you have to separate two things here. There's the policy side, which there is no surprise here. President Trump ran a very aggressive campaign for the presidency where he said he wanted to end the forever wars. He wanted to bring America's men and women back home. He was tired of wasting, you know, billions and in many cases trillions of dollars overseas on these forever wars that just seem to drag on, and there's no discernible victory possible. So why are we doing that? And what I highlight in the book are numerous instances where the president wanted to fulfill one of his campaign promises, for example, banning transgender troops from the military,
mm-hmm.
or he wanted to kind of break down the barriers with North Korea, and to do so he had to cease all military exercises we had going on with South Korea to help protect the peninsula. So those decisions aren't necessarily the crucial point. What the crucial point is that they come out via tweet, and they, you know, if you're in Texas, you're in Ohio, you're in California, you might see this and say, okay, yeah, behind the scenes, it's all planned. And the reality is it wasn't. There was no heads up from the White House. There was no heads up internally to the White House that these were the major decisions that were going to be coming via tweet, you know, minutes down the road. And that's the danger, is when you don't give the millions of men and women who serve this country, both in uniform and as civilians, the opportunity to, as they say, kind of get out in front of your boss, make sure that the path is clear, make sure your allies and partners are comfortable with what we're about to do. If you don't do those things, then that's where you get this sense of constant chaos, because everyone's always trying to catch up. It also means that you're very cautious and in some cases nervous about wanting to take a risk as a decision maker, because the last thing you want to do, and we've seen this happen, is make a decision and then the president maybe a day later comes out and directly countermands that.
Do you think it's a it's a function of being bad management, or that he knew to get stuff by through the bureaucracy is just to make edicts.
I think it's bad management.
Yeah.
There, you're the president of the United States. There's nothing that prevents you from setting things in motion behind the scenes so that you have as smooth as possible. And let's face it. I mean, I've been in the room where the president was making decisions. I've also been in the room where Secretary Mattis and other senior leaders were making these decisions. And when it's time to discuss, and then you know when that individual turns to the senior leaders with a steely-eyed gaze and says, enough talk, we're doing this. And when they make that determination, then everyone in the room knows, okay, discussion time's over. Let's carry out the actions or the orders of the president, the Secretary of Defense, whoever it may be. And so that's, to me, the right course to take. I think there's probably a vestige or a holdover here of, and the president himself has said this, that he likes making sure that everyone knows he's the one in charge, he's the one responsible. And I think that gives him sometimes the desire or offers up the desire that if one of your senior leaders has made a proclamation, then he likes to come out and say, nope, that's not what we're doing. Yeah. We're doing this instead, publicly. And I think the best example for this is the current Secretary of Defense, a gentleman named Mark Esper, took to the podium and said, we're not going to betray our Kurdish partners over in Syria. We're going to, they've been with us to help defeat the terrorist group ISIS. We're not going to abandon them. And then 2 days later, President Trump ordered him to abandon them in a very public fashion. And I think he likes to do that because the president believes it reinforces the view that he's a strong leader.
By the way, let me ask that. Does Trump not see the linkage between actions? He's talking with Erdogan on that case. And right after that, he gives them the go-ahead to go into Syria and potentially obliterate our allies, the Kurds. Does he, when he agreed with Erdogan, did he see the inevitable outcome of that?
This is a long-standing, right? There's no surprise here. There's a lot of political intrigue, not only in D.C., but also internationally. And every nation, of course, is looking to make sure that they can secure and defend their own country. Other countries will play each other off of one another. And, of course, we witness this ourselves in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s with Russia. That continues today, where they'll say one thing publicly but do another thing privately. I don't think that's a surprise. But I just think that there's this interesting simplicity, this belief that, I say something at one time at the podium or I tweet it, and so therefore the whole government is moving. And we saw this recently as well with the decision by the president to grant clemency to three members of the military who had been accused of war crimes overseas and had been, in some cases, convicted. One was a Navy SEAL who had lost his rank and was going to lose his trident, meaning he was no longer going to be a member of the SEAL community. Mm. And the president overruled that via tweet, and the Secretary of Defense said, we're not going to act on that because we don't believe that a tweet is an actual order. So that's kind of what the unusual circumstances and situation we live in today is just sometimes having to separate the wheat from the chaff on what constitutes presidential direction and what's simply for political purposes or for to motivate his base.
On that example, I kind of get the sense that Trump thought that'd be popular in the military, but it's actually not popular in the military to basically sanction war crimes. One other thing on management that's always sort of bothered me about Trump, and the military is very founded upon this, which is loyalty and leadership up and down with accountability. And the president appoints all these guys and then gets rid of all these guys and doesn't attach accountability to himself and doesn't show any downward loyalty.
It's fascinating to me, just as a case in point. And again, look, there's, you have to separate out. There's politics, of course. There's the Republican side, Democratic side, sometimes independent. You've got, the person. You've also got the office of the president. So sometimes these conversations can get a little tricky. But I would agree with you. I think if you look over time, it's somewhat fascinating that when it's discussion of a success, it's always as the president, I did this. I got us a trade deal. The only time I really have heard him say we was this past week when he was impeached, and then he wanted to broaden out the, I guess, responsibility and said, well, it looks like we were impeached, as to say that the administration was somehow impeached. And that's, of course, not the case. The president himself, singularly, was impeached based on the decision of the House of Representatives.
Talking with Guy Snodgrass, he served as Director of Communications and Chief Speechwriter to Secretary of Defense James Mattis for a year and a half.
You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell, Mondays through Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. right here on 1540 AM WADK Newport, or streaming live at WADK.com.
We're excited to announce we've got Jim Campbell Radio now on YouTube. It's got all of our Business Talk with Jim Campbell, our Forensic Talk with Jim Campbell, all in one site. All you have to do is search Jim Campbell Radio, and then please subscribe so you'll be in touch with every new show. Talking with Guy Snodgrass, he served as Director of Communications and Chief Speechwriter to Secretary of Defense James Mattis for a year and a half. Now I'm going to ask you to give an example because it's a great case. You brought the president over to the Pentagon for this briefing, and it was meant to be sort of an overview of the military and I guess the diplomatic State Department side. And like within seconds, the president hijacked the meeting and sort of jumped around. Talk about what that was like.
It was very jarring, and I would tell you it was alarming. I had heard that the president does not like to read in general, that he doesn't like to take briefings, and then that was proven to me when he came to the Pentagon, because you had Secretary Mattis as the Secretary of Defense. You had a gentleman at the time, Secretary Rex Tillerson, who was the Secretary of State. You had Gary Cohn as this economic advisor, and these are all incredibly powerful individuals in the Trump administration. And to your point from earlier in our conversation, the president himself and his team had brought these individuals on because they said, these are the best that we can get. These are the best of the best available to us. You'd like to believe you're going to trust those people. But from the moment the president walked in, it was obviously he was dismissing everything that they were saying. He didn't want to hear about the importance of our allies and partners around the world. He didn't want to hear about the importance of America's military and what it does for the country. What he wanted to talk about was this incredibly long handshake he'd had with President Macron of France. He wanted to talk about a Victory Day parade down Pennsylvania Avenue. And, you know, I'm in the control room running the slides, listening to the conversation, watching the monitors, making sure everything in the room is taken care of. And I'm looking to the Army colonel sitting to my left and saying, like, what is going on here? He's just shaking his head, kind of throwing his hands up, going, like, this is not what I expected. But, you know, it's interesting because you could, you know, we're watching this play out in real time. And I think the conversation, if we were to talk a decade from now, we'd have a lot more context for it. There is truth to look at the other side of the coin. There's truth to the fact that President Trump absolutely challenges the status quo. He challenges the norms that the government has operated on for decades and the way we've operated for decades. And he's not afraid, as we've all seen, to speak his mind. And so I think we'll continue to watch over time to see how that plays out. And that gets back, of course, to the book, which is, you know, in the media space, it kind of got played up as, hey, this is like this inside look into the Trump presidency and into Secretary Mattis's Pentagon, which is absolutely true. But it's really more of a leadership book because it takes a look at how we made these decisions. What are the big impacts to America's military? What's it like to be one of these millions of men and women serving our country, serving patriotically? And at the end of the book, of course, what did I learn? And what you mentioned earlier was I had spent time as a Top Gun instructor. So that is a fantastic tour of duty. But what you learn, the number one rule is once you've done something, it's always important to take a look back and say, okay, what did I learn from that experience? How does that make us better tomorrow? But then how can people following in my footsteps do better as well? And so that's the reason to write this book, but I think that's also the reason for readers to engage with it, because you get a chance to say, okay, I can better understand what's going on with the Trump presidency, but I can also better understand how we got here and what we should be doing moving forward. So again, not trying to go too deep into that political realm, but you know, that's noteworthy to me because that does cut across, that's 180 out from the way military members are trained.
Yeah.
We're trained where if something goes wrong, if you're the one in charge and something goes wrong, you accept responsibility and then you find ways to fix it. If things go right, then you pass that success on to those you lead, right? So it's basically the direct opposite, where you'd sit there and something great happens and you say, hey, this was the team. They did a phenomenal job. We all came together. Good job. If something poor happens, you say, look, you know, that's my fault. We'll fix it and we'll move forward together.
In fact, I've interviewed Navy SEALs guys, and after-action reports are always a big thing of that. Now, in that briefing, Trump says, who gives a S-H-I-T about Afghanistan? Is he right in some ways?
I think he is. There's this interesting interplay, and that's what we're watching play out in some respects right now, which is the old guard, the men and women who have served as civilians, who have been in the Pentagon, been in the federal government for decades. And sometimes when that happens, you know, you can perpetuate the status quo. You take what you inherited and you just move forward with it. Mm-hmm. And you complicate that as well, because you had at the time H.R. McMaster, a Army three-star general who was the national security advisor to President Trump. You had Secretary Mattis, a retired four-star Marine general who had experiences and responsibility for the conflict in Afghanistan. And these were individuals who, in some cases, they'd spent a large portion of their career fighting in Afghanistan, thinking about Afghanistan, and frankly, wanting to win in Afghanistan. And sometimes that's where things can get tricky, because a lot of my peer group, the colonels and captains and commanders, looked around and said, well, you know, this is a lot of money, and will we ever win in Afghanistan? I mean, what does that look like? And, and of course, we just recently had what they're calling the Afghanistan papers were rolled out, which showed that over the course of decades, I guess around 18 years, that senior leaders knew we were losing in Afghanistan, but were saying the opposite to the American public.
Yeah, that's not learning the Vietnam lesson when you have papers like that. This is kind of an unknown scandal. We just had the impeachment around the action to allegedly extort Ukraine when they're at war with Russia. You talk about Amazon's AWS, their web division, bid for a $10 billion Jedi cloud project, and that President Trump intervened to try to make sure that Amazon, owned by Jeff Bezos, would not get it.
Correct. So President Trump called over to Secretary Mattis and directed him to screw Amazon. That's how I put it in the book. You know, hey, I want you to screw Amazon. They're not going to get this $10 billion contract. You know, you need to make this happen. And in that particular meeting, and it wasn't just me and the secretary, there were about a dozen people in his office. Secretary turns to us and says, look, we're not going to do that. We're going to do this legally and ethically by the book. And so that's one of the reasons why I appreciated working for Secretary Mattis. Was I always knew, look, it's Washington, D.C. It's a challenging place. Politics abound. It can be dog-eat-dog, but I always felt confident knowing that I had a boss who would not do something illegal, would not do something unethical, and if someone around him tried to do that, whether no matter who that might be, one, he wouldn't participate, and two, if he was in a place to stop it, he would. So, you know, that's one of the ways in which I think Secretary Mattis served this president so well, is because, that happens in any organization. It's not just the president of the United States. It's not just a senior government leader. I mean, you could be in any organization and have your boss say to you, this is what I want to accomplish. And perhaps the way they want to do it is not appropriate for, a million different reasons. And that's where leaders like Secretary Mattis and others can say, okay, I know what you want to achieve, but here's the right way to do it, if there is a right way.
Listen to Fierce North Talk with Jim Campbell, the adults in the room, coming next.
If you or a loved one is a survivor of abuse by Boy Scouts of America representatives as far back as the 1970s, we urge you to speak up. We'll stand with you and get you the help and financial compensation you deserve. A jury in Portland, for example, awarded $18.5 million in punitive damages in one Boy Scout sexual abuse case. The Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy, and funds have been set aside to compensate those injured. Time is limited, and so are the funds. Call today. Don't wait. For free information on how to file your claim, call All Survivors Advocates right now. We have a long track record in helping our clients get the legal justice and compensation they deserve. Please, we are ready to help you. Call today.
800-364-2984. 800-364-2984. 800-364-2984. That's 800-364-2984.
And we're back with Guy Snodgrass. He has a book just out, Holding the Line, Inside Trump's Pentagon with Secretary Mattis. I want to get into some of the adults in the room, as they were called. But first, we just talked about the Amazon refusal to enact that order, if you will, the military parade, the transgender order, all of those Secretary Mattis slow rolled. Is that one of the what do you think on slow rolling when the president wants to do something, aside from obviously illegal stuff?
You know, it's interesting because it has such a negative context. I'm absolutely a firm believer in it in a lot of circumstances, especially if you have a senior leader who likes to make rash or snap decisions. And your point is very valid the way you asked the question. What if it's illegal? What if it's absolutely inappropriate? What if it cuts against something that the person, in this case the president, has said maybe a month ago that he didn't want to do? And that's where it can be difficult because, again, if you're listening to your show and you're in Colorado or you're somewhere outside the D.C. Beltway, which is 99.9% of our country, you might hear me say that and say, well, gosh, that's ridiculous. If the president says jump, you simply say how high.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that there's some danger there. It's not just a black and white situation. There are many times where, you know, it's like the way I was taught as a junior officer. You know, you have to take a look and say, well, is this urgent and important? If it is, then you probably need to enact the president's direction right this moment. Is it, urgent but unimportant, or is it important but not urgent? Well, hey, there's time. You can wait to enact that decision. And in doing so, you typically can give your boss even better options. And at the end of the day, that's what any boss wants, is they want to get to the best result in the least expensive way, or in the best way, the way that works best for them. And so, no, I don't think that there's any danger in some cases with slow rolling. Now, when you take Secretary Mattis in the parade, for example, Mattis had no intention of ever doing that. And I think that's where it gets dangerous, because the president is the president of the United States. When he says he wants you to do this, you either need to tell him straight up that you will or you won't. And the president has to make a decision at that point about how he feels about you.
Looking back, what would you say were some of the weaknesses of the way he ran his, what you call, front office? I mean, obviously, you talk, the staff, he appears to burn out staff. There was a lack of civilians, maybe groupthink, maybe too much Marine orientation. Looking back, how would you assess some of the weaknesses that could have been done differently?
One thing is just self-awareness, understanding the road you've walked and what that means for the organization. In this case, just like you pointed out, Secretary Mattis, he had retired as a Marine Corps general 3 years before. And that's what he had known his entire adult life, was being a Marine and being, at the end of his career, a Marine general. And that you behave a certain way. You see the world a certain way. You have certain expectations for those who work with you. And, of course, having been out of uniform for such a short amount of time before he came in as Secretary of Defense, he had to get a waiver from Congress to even take the job, meant that he looked at the world like a Marine four-star general. And so that's how he treated his staff. That's how he worked within the Pentagon. And that came with a lot of benefits, a very singular view of what he wanted to accomplish. He was always clear and unequivocal with what he wanted to see the Pentagon do. And that was a huge benefit, because it meant that we could foster that transparency and alignment in the organization. Now, it also came with downsides, and that some of the ways we would enact that would be challenging. He also felt very comfortable having the uniformed military officers basically kind of flip the script, if you will, and start giving orders to much more senior civilians in the Pentagon, and that caused some consternation, because America, of course, has a very strong, long-standing history of civilian control of the military. And while that didn't truly erode, to a dangerous place, it was noteworthy when you have a guy like me, a Navy commander, going to talk to an incredibly senior civilian and saying, hey, I don't really care what you have to say. You're going to do this because I'm telling you to, because the boss is telling me to tell you this. So you know, it was interesting. I mean, I personally grew so much from the experience. I know those around me did as well. And I think it's just the awareness, no matter what organization you work in, it's always determining how can you do the job the best possible way? How can you build that trust and confidence within the team? And what can you do around you? And I'd say the number one thing Mattis could have done differently was to be very cognizant and aware of who he brought in as his own senior leaders, because, you know, for the majority of men and women who serve in the Pentagon, who serve in the military, they're going to interact with those people. They're not going to interact with Secretary Mattis. He doesn't have enough time in the day to talk to everyone personally, but they will talk to those like his chief of staff he brings in. And if you bring in someone who's a team builder and honorable and ethical, then you're going to have a great experience. If you bring in someone who doesn't epitomize those values, you're likely to get the opposite. And I think we saw that second.
Yes. Now I get to the adults in the room. Oh, you can talk about the relationship with the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. It seemed to be very good. And he had the reputation, Tillerson, of gutting the State Department. Tell us about Tillerson.
Personally, I really like Tillerson. I think he had gravitas, meaning when he walked in the room or when he discussed a topic, you knew he was very well read on it. He had done his homework. Because he had been the CEO of ExxonMobil for a number of years, I mean, he had a lot of pre-existing relationships around the world. And he just, as the Secretary of State, that meant he had an innate knowledge of the importance of seeing the other country's views. Doesn't mean you don't, of course, fight for America's views and what we want to achieve, but you at least have an awareness of what it's going to take to accomplish this. And I thought that was a huge benefit. And I liked Tillerson's background. I mean, he was I describe in the book how Tillerson had basically come from nothing, had pulled himself up by his bootstraps, had worked incredibly hard through high school and college and beyond to rise to become the CEO of one of America's, more powerful companies. I think there's a lot to admire in that. And he was also one of the few leaders, on a personal note, who would walk into a room. And of course, you've got, your very, very senior leaders, your cabinet officials. But then you'd have the minions like myself who would be at the table or maybe lining the wall to take notes. And mm-hmm. He would never hesitate to walk over and shake your hand, introduce himself, and want to know a little bit about you. And I thought he just had a really good personal touch. And I think he got a little bit of short shrift in the State Department. He had marching orders from President Trump to shrink the organization. And the press had a field day with it. And that's the power of media. That's the power of our press, is that, there can be a narrative generated, and unless you do something to actively counter that narrative, then suddenly, as we saw, that became the view on Tillerson until his departure.
I talk about your career for a second. I was surprised that you got the job without interviewing with the chief of staff of Mattis or Mattis himself. And the second part of that question is, it seemed to me that you worked your tail off, but kind of got screwed on jobs coming out of it.
Yes. So two things there. It's funny. It's not that unusual in the military. So this gets back to your background. In the military, it's not that unusual that based on the strength of your record and the strength of the recommendations you come into a job with, that the boss may literally, as happened with me, walk in, shake your hand, say, welcome to the team, and walk right back out. I've been vetted at lower levels. I've been vetted on Secretary Mattis's personal staff who had conducted the interview. And, there's a scene in the book where I describe how this deputy chief of staff gets up, walks out, comes back in, and just says, "Congrats! You're our guy." And I was a little surprised by that, but at the same time, I knew that some admirals and generals had made calls on my behalf to say, "Look, this is the guy you want." So I was honored that they were willing to do that, and honored by the opportunity to serve in that capacity. To your second point, yes, that's absolutely true. I was not well taken care of when I left, nor were a vast majority of the people who served with Secretary Mattis. And that's where I think that's one of the biggest detriments to Mattis himself, to his legacy, is that he's not a guy who takes care of his people. You compare and contrast that with another military leader, someone who had run the U.S. Navy under President Ronald Reagan. His name's John Lehman. He was Secretary of the Navy. He did the same thing Mattis did. He brought the best talent he could find to his tent. And when he knew his time as Secretary of Navy was drawing to a close, he actually extended himself for 6 months to help ensure he placed everybody into their next best job, because he had trained these people. He had basically asked them to sacrifice so greatly on his behalf that he knew it was important and an imperative to make sure he took care of them. And I think personally, that's just great leadership. And that's what Secretary Lehman did. And then you compare and contrast that to our office. Every single civilian who had walked in the door either quit out of frustration or was kind of drummed out. In my case, I had a job lined up where I got asked to come be a senior leader in the Pentagon by someone else, and I was told to take it and accepted the job. And then at the last minute, kind of had the rug pulled out from underneath me. And we had a lot of the military members who served with Mattis decide to retire after working with them. So, I think that I've once had someone ask me as a leader, what do I see as the number one sign of success? How do you know you did a good job as a leader? And I think that that's a great telling point is what do the people you lead do after you depart? Do they continue onward, upward? Do they become themselves generals and admirals? Do they lead the organization and do great things? And if so, you not only inspired them, but you also took care of them. And I think that's a critical part of what being a good leader is all about.
He sat at the right hand of General Mattis at the Defense Department. He's Guy Bus Snodgrass. You've talked about this to an extent. Was Mattis there long enough to leave footprints to make a difference? Was he a hold-the-line guy as opposed to a transformational guy? How do you assess it?
Well, he was. He was a hold-the-line guy. In the book, I actually point to another historian, Charles Stevenson, who has researched the first 20, I believe, or 21st, secretaries of defense. And he breaks them into three categories. He says you can be a firefighter, someone who's always putting out the latest crisis. You can be a team builder, a secretary of defense who works well with others in the administration to get things done for the president. You can be a revolutionary in the best sense of the word, meaning you come in and you transform the Department of Defense. And I at the time I wrote the book, and then, of course, as more months have passed, I say Mattis falls squarely into the firefighter camp. He was constantly having to address the latest tweet from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He was dealing with, crises around the world. And he never really got a chance to enact his own, kind of agenda for the military. And he left before he could have had the sustained longevity required to make that kind of difference.
One of the things that I've always been interested in, and by the way, you said you inherited a strategy-free situation, which is really quite an amazing admission. You can talk about it if you want. One of the things that's always gotten me is that you've had General Mattis, Petraeus, McChrystal, who I've interviewed, very, very impressive people. And yet I never heard what the definition of victory was in Afghanistan or Iraq.
We had strategies. We had, different review processes, in the military, but it was a very convenient soundbite. And it was accurate to say that we had gone 10 years without a national defense strategy. It's simply because Congress had said, we don't want a national defense strategy. We want something called a quadrennial defense review. But that's, I think, a great example of the role Mattis can play as a politician. To your point about a definition of victory or success, this gets back to the 1980s when you have someone like General Colin Powell, right? The Powell Doctrine. You don't go in someplace unless you have a clear path to victory, unless you have a well-defined, what does that look like? And that's likely one of the most dangerous aspects of whether it's South Asia with Afghanistan or the Middle East is there is no real clear path to victory or achievable end there. And so how many resources do you continue to throw against it? Of course, lives, money, the equipment. And so that's the difficulty. I think for Afghanistan, it comes down to bringing the Taliban to the table to be able to negotiate where they are part of the government without, through the use of ballots in a democratic system rather than using bombs and terrorism. I've had conversations over the last month, a friend from the Israeli embassy, friend from the South Korean embassy. They still have yet to figure out how the Trump administration is working. They get a lot of mixed signals, so they're not sure which one is the accurate one or which one they should respond to. But more importantly, most everybody I've talked to has consistently said that since America is fading as the partner of choice in their region, that means they have to respond more and find ways to work more with Russia if you're in the Middle East, or with China if you're in the Indo-Pacific.
Do you have a fear? President Trump has never handled a military crisis. Do you have any trepidation?
Well, I think the answer is yes. And we saw a microcosm of this when we pulled out of Syria. It was so much mixed communication. You had the Secretary of Defense take to the podium at the Pentagon and say, we are not going to abandon our Kurdish partners in this fight. The ones who stood by us for years as we defeated ISIS, there's no way. And then 2 days later, President Trump orders him to withdraw from Syria. There was no notice. General McKenzie, who is the Marine four-star commander of the U.S. Central Command, who handles forces in the Middle East, was caught flat-footed. He's expressing alarm to Washington that we could lose lives because of how fast we're pulling out. And, of course, people saw public reports about how we're bombing our own bases to destroy them before the Russians could take them over. And in some cases, the Russians took them over anyway. And then about 2 weeks later, based on public outcry, we send forces back in. But now it's for the stated purpose of securing the oil. Yeah. So, again, this is alarming to our allies and partners, but it also, I think, gives us a little bit of a microcosm of what a crisis might look like. And that's why there's such an importance on relying on people who have decades of experience, people who can help, no matter who the senior leader is, but in this case, President Trump, can help say, here's the path forward, here's our recommendation, here's how we're going to execute this, here's how we're going to carry it out, so that you provide stability and America is still seen as the partner of choice.
We're getting down to the end. You know, I'm kind of surprised about that, not taking care of his people, because he has such a good image. And, you know, there's always the story of him sitting out guarding one of those forward bases so that his soldier could be with his family. It is kind of surprising. And it's also surprising that he had a chief of staff that lied so much. I mean, he was backstabbing people.
He was, and that's what surprised me the most. And it's funny, it's the only job I've ever walked into in my entire career where within 30 days, you know, there's the promise of Mattis, there's the promise of the job you're going into, and the excitement. You get there, and within 30 days, you kind of go, uh-oh. You know, it's not being run, and the people aren't treating each other the way you would expect. And I see it as what an embarrassment of riches for the first 18 years of my career that I was a fighter pilot, that I worked alongside amazing men and women who largely went out of the way to take care of each other and not try to find ways to stab each other in the back.
Do you think Secretary Mattis, I mean, these are all serious worries and issues, that Secretary Mattis should be speaking out on this?
He understands, you know, as a politician, it's important for him not to. He has a book he's selling. He's going back on the boards of corporations. And if you speak out publicly, it makes that path challenging. And it also means that he's probably going to turn off half the country who doesn't necessarily want to hear what he has to say. And so therefore, now he's been diminished. So I think that's the challenge. I would tell you that's why I felt comfortable writing my book. One, it's an apolitical book, so I didn't pick a side. Mm-hmm. But I also always felt like my loyalty was with the United States of America. It's not to one individual. And I think that's the concern, is that if you fail to speak out at the moment when it can make the difference, Americans should have as much information as they possibly can to make an informed decision across the board. And this could be on any topic, but I would always prefer people have more information to make a decision than less.
I want to thank Guy Snodgrass. It was a very fast hour. The book is great, and you get a real sense of the burning pace these folks worked under to keep the world together when our allies were so confused about what the heck we were doing. The book, again, is called Holding the Line Inside Trump's Pentagon with Secretary Mattis. Thanks again to Guy. Thanks to our national audience for listening.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy. I think you're going to like this one. I interview so inartfully, awkwardly, and imprecisely, as you well know. Today we're talking with a master interviewer. I've been interviewed by him. His name is Jim Campbell, James Campbell, and he comes from a Connecticut station. He's up in Vermont. He's in a station near Yale. He's all over New England, and he's written a book. And you won't believe, where'd you get the idea for doing a book out? What's that guy's name?
I think it's Bernard L. Madoff.
Yeah.
People may have heard of him. Bernie Madoff.
I love it.
Biggest Ponzi scheme in history. And I'll tell you how it happened. I was doing an interview with a woman that wrote a book that Andrew Madoff, who was his son and girlfriend, cooperated with. So I said, before you come on, can I interview Andrew? Which would be off the air because he couldn't talk. This is his son, Andrew, who was the younger son. The other son committed suicide, and Andrew died of leukemia. But so we spoke on the phone off the air, and I said, I think so far that you're innocent. And he said, and then we're going to be live tomorrow. I asked him some tough questions, which he answered off the record. And then the next day, I said, I'm going to say on the air that I think you did not know. And he says, I'm going to listen to see if you do that. And I did it. And then he introduced me to his mother, Ruth, who I became friends with. Mm-hmm. And then Ruth introduced me to Bernie in prison. And that's how this whole thing...
You visited him in prison?
I have not visited him. I have 300 pages of communications, and I have the most extensive media relationship with him, is how he describes it. And he's a brilliant guy. And unfortunately, the more that I'm I had done research on the book... a lot of what he says hasn't turned out to be true.
Bernie Madoff. When is this book coming out, Jim?
The earliest it'll be out will be mid-2020.
And what's the title?
It is Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Truth Behind the Biggest Ponzi Scheme in History.
Tell me about Bernie Madoff. You've exchanged a lot of, his family. Was he just a bad guy?
He's actually a low-key guy. He's actually comes across as very friendly and personable. The problem with Bernie is that he cannot accept any level of defeat or anything. Hmm. So he goes overboard on stuff, and that's what led him to do all kinds of nefarious stuff. He had some big investors who actually made much more money than he did over time. And he couldn't say no to them. And, I mean, they would literally down to the level of they would call up and say, I'd like this backdated to this. I want this level of profit and this gain. Or the other way, I want this loss for my taxes. And all made up. And so what Bernie told me initially was that he lost some money in 1992 because of these guys. Instead of calling them on it, he took the loss and then doubled up on Ponzi money. The truth has ended up, unfortunately, being since he's in business in the end of the 60s, on that illegal side of the business, there was never any real trading. It was a complete fraud from day one, which kind of boggled my mind.
Jim Campbell, who made money off Bernie Madoff?
The number one guy was a guy named Jeffrey Pickauer, who made $7.2 billion off of Madoff and had to give it all back. But Bernie, never even worth over $1 billion. So there's an interesting thing. Most Ponzi schemes, the guy at the center is making all the money, which tells you that it was not about greed. It's about ego and power and an inability to say no. And the guy... Let me tell you, unbelievably brilliant mind. The front side of his business was called a market-making business, and what that meant was if Schwab was looking to do trades, they would route them through Bernie's shop so that Bernie did the order execution and everything, and Schwab had the customer out front. Totally legitimate, totally honest, overboard on Wall Street ethics. Ends up being like a mafia business. It was like the restaurant out front. Mm. And back here, completely illegal. So,
what does it say, Jim Campbell? You're a broadcaster, now an author. What does it say about this country that we almost worship guys who make money?
It's and the next point to there is that we want to believe con men. We want to believe that he could be this wizard, that he could defy the market, that he never lost money, that every year he made money. And part of that blame goes with us because it was too good to be true. And we tend to believe too good to be true. The other thing it doesn't say well about our country, which is part of the themes in my book, which is the regulatory agencies all let us down. Mm. There are a lot of investors, mom and pop, who put 30 years of their life savings in, who were not rich, And they thought that the SEC had blessed him. They thought, the FDIC protects your money in the bank. The equivalent to the brokerage business is SIPC, S-I-P-C. Turns out SIPC doesn't cover Ponzi schemes. So I lost money. Don't I get like the FDIC would do if a bank went bankrupt? So the system let people down, too.
What about smart guys like Joe Perella and I've mentioned Mike Bloomberg, the Solomons. How come they didn't blow the whistle on this guy?
I think they didn't blow the whistle just because it's not really what's done on Wall Street, you know, to turn somebody else. All these guys know all the bad stuff that's going on behind the scenes. And, you know, even these legitimate firms do a lot of sleazy stuff.
Jim Campbell, wasn't Bernie Madoff promising returns of 15% no matter what?
Yeah.
Everybody else says, I'll give you 3%.
He was towards the end, right? It was 11%. It was 1% a month, basically. Basically, no matter what happened to the market, it was 1%. Now, here's what he did for his big guys. The big guy would send him money, a lot of money, and sometimes help bail him out.
What do you mean the big guy? 10 million? 50 million?
The $7 billion was the biggest guy.
$7 billion
that made up. But what he was doing for them was, you know, when you're a Ponzi, you have to keep getting more money or you're out. And this guy would sometimes give him money if he was short. So in return, Bernie would give him 30% returns. Where was that 30% coming? From the poor guy over here who'd given him money who was only getting 11. He was taking that guy's money and giving it to him, and then you got to bring in more. That's a pretty good deal for Pickhauer, which is the guy's name.
The book is called Bernie Madoff. Is that what it is?
Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Truth Behind the Biggest Ponzi Scheme in History.
Say again.
Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Truth Behind the Biggest Ponzi Scheme in History.
And it'll be out in about 6 months?
In mid-August.
Good for you. And you got a high-class publisher, I hear.
McGraw-Hill. Very nice people.
And the author is Jim Campbell.
Very nice. And I hope to be half the writer you are.
Well, I struggle with it. Thank you, Jim Campbell, broadcaster, author. And that should be a hell of a book,
Bernie
Madoff. All the Secrets. Thank you. Great stuff.